Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Veronica Monet is a relationship and sexuality coach found at theshamefreezone.com, and she is returning to the show. And this time, our focus will be on codependency and body shame. The last time Veronica was on this program, May 9th, we touched on the subjects. This time we'll explore them more in depth. Welcome back to Love, Lust, and Laughter, Veronica.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. I hope you're having a great day, Diana. It's absolutely beautiful here in Northern California.
Well, I returned to Seattle yesterday from California, but it's gone back to cloudy and threatening rain, which is a little disappointing, because when I left, it was so beautiful. Anyway, I still love this Emerald City, Seattle, and I think we'll have summer pretty soon, where it's more consistently sunny
Seattle.
And nice. Yeah,
Seattle,
you do?
Seattle's I've spent a lot of time up there on tour after my book came out in 2005, and love the people of Seattle, love the city of Seattle, and hope to get up there again soon.
Yes, and the book, do you want to just talk about that a tiny bit before we get into common misunderstandings about codependency? So your book was 2005.
Yeah, it's through Penguin, which is a major press. It's called Sex Secrets of Escorts.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's very interesting. The book's been out for over 10 years. So I've sold just shy of 15,000 copies worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been translated into four different languages. Some interesting ones, like Romanian and the Czech Republic just bought the rights to it last year. So
That your book has all this life in it. It's great.
It's got an international fan base, which is really cool.
Yeah.
So, as a matter of fact, my mother and I are going over to Europe in October, and I'm thinking about stopping by the Czech Republic just to say hi to a few of my fans.
Oh, you should. That would be a fascinating experience.
Yeah, really.
Yes. So in your work, you come across codependency a fair amount, as you do body shame. And as I said in the introduction, we touched on these on May 9th, but let's go into them a little bit more. I think the first really good question is, what is a very common misunderstanding about codependency?
Well, you know, because it has that word dependent in it, people think that a codependent person is kind of needy or clingy. And that is one type of codependency. So characteristically, people think about somebody who doesn't seem to have a life of their own and needs to have somebody else with them all the time and maybe even doesn't support themselves. They're kind of dependent upon this other person to take care of them. But codependency has a lot of faces. And I always like to tell people the most extreme example of codependency that I know of is those situations where we hear about on the news, tragic situations, horrific situations, where a guy is left by his girl or his wife, and he tracks her down, shoots her dead, and then puts a bullet through his own head.
Mm-hmm.
So those murder-suicide, to me, is probably the most extreme form of codependency I can think of.
It
really illustrates how codependency can be not just debilitating, but it can be lethal.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who the typology of the kind of guy that would permit to commit that kind of a crime is usually somebody who is probably bringing the income in, so he's not financially dependent on the woman in his life, and he may be even cheating on her, so he's not sexually dependent upon her either. And it could be that his relationship with her is defined exclusively around domestic violence, that he's simply using her as a punching bag. And that in itself is his codependency. He cannot function without having somebody to scapegoat and brutalize. And that's the face of codependency that is often ignored or just not seen in those terms. But if you absolutely, positively have to have another person to put down and abuse or otherwise humiliate, you're codependent.
And of course, these are extreme examples. In my practice, I don't get these very much, but I think it makes a lot of sense that to have this relationship defined around domestic violence because he needs a scapegoat. I don't get the murder suicide things, but of course we read about them and they're always shocking.
You know, one of the reasons that I bring up extreme examples is to get people's attention about their own personal lives that are probably a little more mundane and less dramatic. I get couples who yell at each other, slam doors, and sometimes block the doorway when the other person is trying to get out of the conversation and say, "No, I'm not done talking." Or they chase each other around the house and go, "You will listen to me." Or maybe they throw a dish and break a cup, or they, they threaten to, "That's it. I'm going to take the kids and leave you." And these kinds of behaviors are actually, they won't get you put in jail for domestic violence, but they are a form of abuse and a form of violence. And if people engage in those kind of behaviors unchecked, it can eventually lead to more severe actions. But
yes,
obviously
because it's definitely emotional abuse.
Well, yeah, and interestingly enough, most people would say that emotional scars are far more painful than physical scars.
So, yes, I certainly have seen that over the years, that emotional scar tissue is so deep that it's really hard to make changes.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes a lot of healing, doesn't it?
A lot of healing. It seems to me that the origins of codependence have to do with being a child of maybe a narcissistic parent or sometimes called a emotional manipulating parent. And so the child destined to be a codependent will go to great lengths to perfect their pleasing persona.
That's one aspect of codependency, certainly. Mm-hmm. But codependency is pretty much embedded in the culture. Our movies are codependent. Our romance novels are codependent. Our songs are codependent. Our romantic ideal is codependent. So the dance of interdependency, this moving away from a codependent paradigm and into what interdependency and true partnership looks like, is actually a revolutionary act. If you move in that direction, you will be moving away from the dominant culture and the dominant definitions of what love looks like into something that I think is a lot healthier and a lot more fulfilling.
Oh, for sure. But that often does take some therapy to help make the change. You know, you were talking about how it's embedded in our culture. There was a song, and it originally was recorded by the Platters in 1955, and it was called "The Great Pretender," and it's supposedly about a sad song about an adult who learned to act this way out of harm's way, but to be a pretender, and it's about a love affair, but I think it could also describe a codependent raised by a narcissistic parent. And you're probably too young to remember this song, but I do remember it.
I wasn't even born then.
I know. So the song goes like this. "Oh, yes, I'm a great pretender, pretending that I'm doing well, My need is such, I pretend too much. I'm lonely, but no one can tell. Oh, yes, I'm a great pretender, adrift in the world of my own. I've played the game, but to my real shame, you've left me, and to grieve all alone.
All right, are you going to sing this for us? That'd be cool.
No, I don't sing well enough to do that. But I sort of remember the lyrics.
Oh, I think you remember them really well.
Well, no, I have them in front of me. But I remember, you know, I do remember the tune. And it ends like this. Yes, I'm the great pretender, just laughing and gay like a clown. I seem to be what I'm not, you see. I'm wearing my heart like a crown, pretending that you're still around.
Oh, how sad.
Yes, how sad. So the child of it pretends a lot if he's trying to make his narcissistic parent happy.
Oh, my God. Well, that's another whole topic, having a narcissistic parent. That's what a horrible thing, because then we don't learn how to validate ourselves. We're constantly trying to meet the emotional needs of a parent who
is
basically a child.
That's right, and it really screws up people. You've seen it in your practice. I see it in mine. Because they are not learning to value caring for themselves. I think future codependents naturally and automatically feel comfortable in relationships in which their needs are secondary or ignored while feeling compelled to take care of someone else. So that's why often a codependent marries a narcissist or an emotional manipulator. So
but just to clarify, there is this other codependent person who is a control freak who is not trying to cater to other people's needs in the family unit, but rather trying to dominate everybody and get everything done their way. So in some ways, you know, I look at codependency as a family disease, and there's a way in which that parent, that narcissistic parent, is also codependent because they don't actually know how to function without somebody else helping them feel whole or loved.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the ways that go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I think that's a very good point. A family disease. They just don't know how to function.
I tell people, you know, first of all, like, since I really specialize in coaching couples and also men, probably 80% of my practice is men. And I think I just have a unique grasp of male culture, no doubt from my background as a
escort.
So I find that codependency looks different in men, but
I wanted to ask you about that. Does it look different does it look the same in men and women or different?
No, I think with women a lot of times the codependency, it'll have a more it's harder to see where the control issues are. Because it looks so service based, you know. Let me do this for you. Here, I made that for you. Here, this is done for you. Oh yes, of course, I'll show up for you. And it just looks like it's so much based upon service that you have to kind of work to see the control issues. And it usually erupts its little nasty head with this particular phrase: "After all I've done for you."
That's right.
Yeah. So if you hear yourself saying that, you know that you've tipped over into codependent behavior. Now you're not just loving and giving freely. You are having expectations, which is always a sign of a codependent behavior.
Yeah.
With men, what I have found is their codependency often takes the form of having absolutely no emotional life of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So they are looking to the woman in their life to supply them with emotional contact. If you I remember one survey that I read that said, if you ask women who their best friend is, it will be another woman. If you ask men who their best friend is, it's usually a woman too.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
It's really, really sad commentary that the men of this world are nobody's best friend and not even their own. And in a lot of ways, you know, it's because the way we raise little boys where they're not allowed to be whole human beings. So they're missing this rich emotional connection to themselves and to others. Now, I'd like to think that that is shifting with the millennials and subsequent generations, but I'm not real confident in that because I've got clients that are in their 20s and I still see this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that for men, a lot of times, they've got to look at that place like, do I know how I feel? Can I go find my feelings without her asking me how I'm feeling? And furthermore, if I tell you how I feel, does it start with, well, she's pissed off at me? That's not a feeling. How do you feel? So I have to work really hard to help my male clients get in touch with their feelings and understand how those are. And then, of course, find a way to express those that doesn't involve anger or acting out or avoidance. Seems like the male pattern is to avoid or get angry. Whereas with women, a lot of times it tends to be I suppose, a certain amount of shaming. They'll shame their partners, played with their partners, try to bargain with their partners, manipulate their partners. And all of these things are not, you know, the way I understand codependency, and I've actually been in recovery around it myself since 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, for your listeners, my favorite all-time book, this is a book that came out in the 80s, but it's still quite current, and there's a brand new version of it, an updated version of it, Melody Beattie's Codependent No More.
Right, right. It was first written in the mid-80s, I think.
It was, and they've got, you know, you can get it on audio version now. Most of my millennial clients do not like to read. They'd rather listen to a book. So it's available that way too. But anything that doesn't have built into it the ability to contact your own feelings and connect with those and report on them, as well as asserting healthy boundaries without creating separation. So a healthy boundary, you think about boundaries, what's the difference between a boundary and a wall? A boundary just lets you know where the container is. Like, okay, here, we're going to have a baseball diamond. Here's the boundary of the baseball diamond, and here's the outfield, and this is out of bounds. So, but we don't build a wall. We have an agreed upon boundary so that we know how to play the game. And I like to think of healthy boundaries in relationships the same way. We are finding a way to play nice with each other, and keep our hearts connected.
That's a good phrase. Play nice with each other while keeping our hearts connected.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But don't you find that some people, going back to this emotional scar tissue, some people just have too much of it built up. It's really, really difficult to see the light and to make changes.
When I'm working with a client like that, I often experience them as being kind of a bottomless pit. No matter how much love and caretaking they receive from their partner, it's never enough.
That's right. It is a bottomless pit.
Yeah, it's just this horrible wound that they have. So I will oftentimes ask them to start coming to see me on an individual basis and suspend the joint sessions with their partner. Because I want them to focus on healing themselves and stop looking to their partner and the relationship to fix that. Yeah.
Yes. And that's where I make the distinction between want and need. And I think ideally you should be able to look at even somebody that you're getting serious about before you're really committed, and it would be to say, I want you even more than I need you. you know, I can live without you, but oh my goodness, I can live so much better with you.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah, and I think that's an important thing to ask yourself, even when you're 10, 20 years into a relationship. Our need can start to creep in on us, and we kind of can sometimes fall into codependency without even knowing it, especially mm-hmm. in a long-term relationship. So I like to check with myself every so often and just go, you know, it's that same test that you're talking about. Is it a need or is it a want?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think generally speaking, we should want our partner a little more than we need them. However, if it's need, it's not the codependent need. It's more, it's kind of can be kind of sticky. It's more of an interdependence where, you know, I find some of the couples I see have worked out some things, some day-to-day things in their relationship that really work well for their specific talents. Like if one person really is good with numbers and accounting, one person manages the budget, the checkbook,
right,
or the online checking these days. And so whoever is better at something will take that over. And then
sure.
They communicate
division
about
of labor.
It. A division of labor, yes.
Yeah.
So your answer is to codependency does not look the same in men and in women, and I really like your distinction about the men not knowing how they're feeling and helping them get into what the feeling is and what's underneath it.
Yeah, because usually what will happen is the woman will feel her codependency around maybe life circumstances. Finances become big. Women stay in abusive relationships because they're afraid of losing a home or access to money or you know, support in raising children. And so that can make them feel very dependent. Now, that doesn't mean that it's codependent to have those need sets, but mm-hmm. it can tip over into an emotional codependence where you're trying to manipulate the relationship because you're afraid of losing mm-hmm. those benefits. And with men, I more often see that they've got an emotional dependence on the relationship. They may feel like they can provide for themselves and don't actually need the relationship financially. And of course, these are all just averages. Everybody's different. There's plenty of women out there who are making more money than their guy. But in general, unfortunately, we still live in a society where women don't make as much money as men. And so this particular generalization tends to hold.
That's very true, Veronica.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. And men
true.
Will tend to have trouble accessing their emotions. So they may still be able to have the same amount of money and the same housing and all this, depending if there's children, they could actually be, the courts might give them less than her. But if it's not a relationship with children and they're not married and they just walk separate ways, he may feel a little less dependent on her than she feels on him because of the economic disparity. But emotionally, what I have seen with female clients is they're going to get the therapy. They're going to read the self-help books. They're going to go to support groups. They're going to have girlfriends. And they're going to get past it and move on. And the guy is going to be lost. And he won't even know how to grieve the loss of the relationship. And then he's not going to know how to get help to move on. And so he might actually just kind of get sullen, get drunk, or have a bunch of one-night stands that never actually solve, you know, his grief mm-hmm. and have a lot of trouble moving on into another relationship. So those are the kind of dependencies that I see in general that divide out by gender.
Yeah, there is something called doing a good emotional divorce, and that means you really do an evaluation, a self-evaluation. How did I contribute to the divorce in both positive and negative ways? I mean, yeah. The relationship, you know, how was it positive? How was it negative? How did I contribute? And ideally, both people should do that. Otherwise, you're very likely to make the same mistakes in a second marriage or a third marriage.
Because
you haven't done the emotional work.
I have couples come to me and they just want to know whether or not they should stay together. And I'm like, that should be your last question. I don't care if you stay together or you don't. What I care about is let's work this relationship so that you can mm-hmm. both grow. And you'll either stay together or you'll move on. But either way, you'll get the lesson and it will make your life better with this person or with another one.
Precisely. Yeah. And keeping your eyes open through all relationships, whether you're married or not or just committed and then you separate, you've got to keep your eyes open. You've got to learn and improve. And in that way, you can reframe failure after a relationship that goes off the tracks and say, no, I've learned from this. I've become a better person. And I'm going to do better in the next relationship because I have learned. So it's not really a failure.
I got divorced in 2004, and I definitely do not consider that a failure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I learned so much. I grew so much. I have some really fond memories. My ex and I are still good friends.
Good for you.
What's the failure in that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's wonderful that you've been able to stay friends. It's also very civilized to do that.
We were holding hands in the judge's chambers when we got our divorce finalized, and he looked at us and he goes, I guess you're not going to be contesting this. Either one of you, are you? We're like, no. It's all good. Just sign the paperwork.
Veronica, I'm going to guess that the sex in that marriage was good.
It was. It was good. And actually, we had some good sex after the marriage.
Right.
For a while.
Well, it's familiar and it's... It's you have the memories. So
we had off and on 30 years, and some of that time we were married, some of the time we weren't, but at this point it's just a phone call once every 3 or 4 months. That's about it.
we are
definitely not compatible. We never were. Which mm-hmm. isn't to say that we didn't have a lot of fun together. We really did. But I'm with somebody I'm much more compatible with now. And the difference is huge.
Well, good for you. Yes, it makes all the difference to have a compatible mate who is well-balanced and healthy. And and the relationship is drama-free. I mean, well, that's what I have now, and it's such a relief to have a relationship that's drama-free, and if you have conflict, you repair it pretty quickly.
That's for you.
Yes.
That's for you.
I feel very fortunate. So we were also going to talk, besides codependency today, we were going to talk about, but you know what we didn't do quite yet?
What's that?
Well, we did some of it. That you wanted to talk about the first steps to heal from codependency, and then we can into body shame. But we should talk about healing, because I have some ideas about that, too, but I want to hear yours mostly.
Okay. Well, first, of course, we mentioned Melody Beattie's Codependent No More, fabulous book. Still fabulous after all these decades.
All right.
And if you don't believe me, just go look at how highly rated it is on Amazon. And mm-hmm. then the other thing is that I really focus on assertion skills. So the first thing I do with somebody who's suffering from codependency is I just talk about healthy boundaries, because that's usually kind of a foreign concept, where I end and you begin.
Precisely.
And, what are my needs? How do I feel? What do I want? What do I need? As codependents have a really hard time. And that applies to both genders. See, that's how I know it's codependency. because a person who's busy waiting hand and foot on the family has a hard time tapping into how they feel. And the guy who is busy getting all of his emotional connection from her can't tell you how he feels. So if I talk to a person who doesn't know how they feel and what they want, I'm pretty sure we're dealing with some codependency. And so the first thing we got to do is start dealing with healthy boundaries, which all that revolves around who I am, what I want, what I need. Mm-hmm. And after that stress, then the really tricky part here is how to assert those boundaries in a way that doesn't create distance and separation. Because we're all wanting to feel close, and so the risk is we will not assert because we're afraid of losing connection. And I teach, I actually teach a five-step process that I call the Exquisite Partnership Formula, and I'd love to share that with your listeners. I am in the process of putting together a free gift, and it should be up in, I'm thinking, another week or two, and it's going to talk all about this Exquisite Partnership Formula, and you'll be able to get that when you go over to my website, theshamefreezone.com. But anyway,
wonderful.
this five-step process really helps create connection in the face of saying no. And so instead of pushing somebody away from you energetically, you pull them into you closer and create more love, more juiciness, even though you've said no. And I just think it's so much fun to do this. Anyway.
Yeah, there are so many codependents who are people pleasers. So saying no is really hard for a lot of them.
Yeah.
The codependents. So that's great that you're going to teach that, how to say no. And realizing that the world will not stop spinning because you've said no.
Well, more importantly, that there's a process, a five-step process where you can actually open somebody's heart, make them feel so loved, so appreciated, so close to you, and all in the context of saying no.
So this will be up on your website. And as I always do, I'll put it up when I do a review of the show.
Wonderful.
The show
should
be archived by tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I got to get the last one that we did out to my email list Thursday. So
good.
I'll send that out to all my peeps so they can tune in to you and I.
Good. Sounds good. I think we're good on the radio together.
I think we are too.
Yes. You're very knowledgeable, and you've experienced life, and that makes a difference.
I sure have. I joke, Veronica did it, so you don't have to.
That's very good, Veronica. I'm making a note of that. Veronica did it, so you don't have to. Yes. Well, so... you also talk in your practice a lot about body shame. And
I do. And, you know, I run into this so much, Diana, because I'm dealing with sexuality. You know, I was just talking to a couple of women yesterday, both of them having issues around their bodies. And it's so painful how much women agonize over their bodies and feel like their body has to look a certain way for them to feel like they deserve to feel a certain way.
That is very true. And I think that the most frequent setting for self-doubt about one's body is in the bedroom. And so with my sex therapist hat on, I want to examine how does a woman's image of her body affect her sexuality and her relationship with her partner? And it affects it big time. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, what you've noticed, and then I'll share what I've noticed.
And I just want to say that it creates in me so much empathy, and I feel so much agony for the women around this entire globe for thousands of years have had so much oppression generated towards their bodies, trying to control their bodies, trying to cover their bodies, cutting their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from Chinese foot binding to Victorian corsets to, you know, today's breast implants, which have now just been linked to a type of lymphoma that is specific to breast implants. And it just makes me so sad. And every single one of us has to choose what we do and don't want to do with our bodies. But it seems like every one of us feels all this pressure to look a certain way. And mm-hmm. it depends, of course, on what part of the planet you live on. But there's still, almost in all cultures, some idea of what a woman should look like. Now, the only time that I found that not to be true is when I was scuba diving in Papua New Guinea about 20 years ago. And I asked a man, our taxi driver, what his criteria was for a wife, because they can have multiple wives over there. And he said, she must be strong. Still emphasis on the body, but not how it looks. So
that's fascinating. And I think that was the same place that the women were fine with being overweight, which was popular in the culture, until television started to come in. And then women started having, I think it's New Guinea. It might have been Bali or Tahiti or... But anyway, once they had images of Western actresses and people, then the eating disorders started to flood in.
Well, I'm not sure that was Papua New Guinea, but I do know that the Christians came over to Papua New Guinea and made them ashamed to go topless, so now they all have to wear T-shirts.
That was certainly true in Hawaii, because I used to live there.
Exactly.
But long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So... if you go back, I always start, when I'm working with women, I always want to take them on a history lesson. And I take them back thousands of years to the earliest figurines of human beings. The earliest time that human beings decided we're going to sculpt an image of another human being. And you probably know this, Diana, but it's the goddess of Wallendorf.
Mm-hmm.
And the goddess of Wallendorf is pregnant. She has folds of fat all over her thighs and her hips and her belly, and her breasts are burgeoning with milk. She is incredibly rotund. And this, they just found thousands and thousands of figurines of the goddess of Wallendorf buried all over, I think, Europe and Asia and Africa. And don't quote me on that. I'm not entirely sure about the locus mm-hmm. of it, but I know there were thousands of them. It was the most popular figurine, the oldest one known. And that was the feminine ideal. So we've come a long way since then. And not necessarily in a good way. I'm really want to embrace whatever works for any individual woman as far as her body. And but I do like to know the history of it is that mm-hmm. a lot of the pressures that come down on women are both classist and racist. And so we'll find that there was a standard for beauty back in the Romantic period. You think about the Rubenesque paintings where the women had very, very white skin and quite a bit of fat on their bodies. And that was considered the ideal because at that particular time, the aristocrats were staying out of the sun and getting
right.
to eat more food than the peasantry. And then by the time we get to the... let's say the early 60s, everything's been flipped. We've had an industrial revolution, which has put all the poor people into factories, and their skin is very white, and they're eating inexpensive food, which tended to be things like boxed macaroni and stuff that is more likely to make you fat.
Mm-hmm.
And the wealthy people were jetting off to the Caribbean to go on their little detoxes and sit in the sun and get a tan.
Mm-hmm.
So our beauty standards have pretty much followed the money. And
very good point, Veronica. Beauty standards following the money.
I feel a lot of gratitude to some of the Hispanic and African-American artists who have injected a different body type into the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that now we've got actually a lot of women are trying to get a big butt, which I think is just so funny, the way people's tastes go with whatever is on their screen, whether that's a television screen or a smartphone screen or a laptop screen. And we're looking at the screen to tell us what we ought to look like.
I think the Kardashians have had a huge influence on the big butt be more desirable now. You know,
I think so.
When I was in my 20s and I was less confident then, someone might compliment me on my body and I'd think to myself, oh, but doesn't he see my thighs, you know, my chubby thighs?
Aww.
And at that point, I just wasn't able to see my body as it was, as others might see it, as say, a unique shape embodying my individuality. And I believed I had to change my body before I could love it. And, of course, I started to learn that that was not conducive to my sexuality, for being present and experiencing pleasure and giving pleasure. Many people do believe that self-hatred is a catalyst for positive change. It's just amazing to me that people believe this. Because
that's a hard one to let go of.
Sure, self-loathing tends to increase stress eating and the production of fat-storing hormones, hormones.
Cortisol. Yes,
cortisol.
Absolutely.
And so it's important, I think, for especially women, because women tend to be the best at this above men, they need to replace bouts of mental self-flagellation with, I think, deliberate kindness. Finding something to like and even admire about their physiques.
Mm-hmm.
And to see it, to cultivate the ability to appreciate one's uniqueness. And when you start to appreciate your imperfections as endearing distinctions, then you will have begun to love yourself in a way that allows you to love others. And people can't do that if they're constantly being self-critical. They can't really love another deeply and authentically if they're circling back around and criticizing themselves so much.
So true. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing is I like to change wording. So I don't believe, like, when I hear a woman say something about, well, she's really, I can't aspire to the beauty ideal, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are these impossible beauty standards. Some of this wording for me is, it just militates against reality, because, first of all, that means that you're believing that whatever the culture is telling you is beautiful is in fact beautiful. And if that's what you believe, then it has no room for the different races at all, because the prevailing beauty standard is always Caucasian. So right there, we've just eliminated the vast majority of people on this planet. And that to me is not just sad, but it's criminal. So I don't even want to use that word, beauty, unless it's personal beauty. What is my personal beauty?
Mm-hmm.
What do I find beautiful? And I don't have imperfections. I have things that make me unique. So
yes.
Otherwise, I'm buying into a culture which is based on racism and classism, and I don't want to be a part of it. And as you know, my own journey has had me all over the map trying to gain weight from my father so he'd stop calling me skinny, and then lose weight for a trainer because he thought I needed to be more fit. And you know, I've seen a lot of women agonize over, oh, he likes me this way, he likes me that way, oh, he wants me fat, oh, he wants me skinny. It's mm-hmm. like, what do you want?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of us have been so programmed to look in the mirror and look in the magazines that I have found the best way to get away from all of that is, how do you want to feel in your body? Are there certain ways that when you are in this particular form, you enjoy the way it feels?
Mm-hmm. That's a very important question because, there are people that might be overweight even, and I've known these women, but they can still feel sensuous and graceful. And then when they start be more kind to their body and accept their body and actually sometimes they're with a man who says, oh, I love your curves. But even if she's with a man who doesn't say that, if she can begin to appreciate herself more because it's tied in with self-esteem, then it's a good thing.
I know women. I choose not to call them overweight unless, of course, it's a medical condition that their doctor's diagnosed. Mm-hmm. But if women with opulent bodies are far more sensuous than some women who have the Barbie doll ideal.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and I've heard men say that they'd rather have a more voluptuous woman than a stick-thin model type whose hip bones will be kind of, during lovemaking, will be just...
Well, I don't want to disrespect the women with hip bones and
model
figures.
No, I'm not disrespecting. I'm just telling you...
Some of my best friends look like that. And also, I don't want to cater to what men want. I'm tired of what men want.
Good point. I'm just telling you what I've heard some men say. And
yeah, well, the men can shut up for a while.
About that, okay?
I am. When it comes to women's bodies, it's mm-hmm. time for women. It's time for women to find what is true for them, and for women to do the talking. And the women to start changing the culture in a way that loves women, embraces women, and affirms women. And it's so important, Diana, beyond even body shame. It's so important as far as our dignity, mm-hmm. Because our bodies are heavily controlled. Whether we're talking about our reproductive rights or what mm-hmm. kind of clothing we're allowed to wear or the freedom of movement, women who are not even allowed to drive cars in Saudi Arabia, there's ways in which women's bodies are controlled, and it's so important that we start defining that we start being the ones who decide what is best for us and really support each other in that.
I agree with you. You are a feminist extraordinaire, I think. And
I am.
Yes. And you probably...
And my feminism seems to pull men in for some damn reason.
Well, you pull in strong men who appreciate an independent, self-thinking woman, right?
I guess. I think men are hungry for it, and they don't know it, but I think they're hungry for it. I think feminism is for all of us, regardless of our gender.
Right. Right. No, I agree with you. I agree with you. So just shifting slightly, I do see women with what I sometimes call self-image neurosis. And mm-hmm. this is a way for some women to avoid being sexual, kind of an excuse not to abandon herself to another. And going back to when she's fixated on, the girth of her hips, her thighs, or the tilt mm-hmm. of her breasts, then she may lose her sensitivity to her partner and become unable to communicate that she cares for him. So yeah. I do think that such preoccupation with one's own anatomy may represent a hampering and a self-defeating form of sexual narcissism.
So how do you work with that?
You work with that by getting them more comfortable with their bodies, doing the exercises like standing naked and alone, standing naked in front of a mirror, and start by touching parts of your body that you really like and appreciate, and then other parts of your body that you don't much so like, but reminding them that these parts function. Maybe it's your belly, but you still digest food well. Maybe it's your thighs, but you still walk well. Your legs get you from place to place. So it's more self-acceptance than rejection. And
now, Diana, do you work with clients who have eating disorders and body dysmorphia? Because it's not the same as body shame, but it is.
I work with them some. Years ago when I was in Palo Alto, I worked with them more. But I do work occasionally with a woman who has eating disorders. Mm. But with anorexia, even years ago in Palo Alto, I learned to not work with anorexics. They were better off working with a psychiatrist who was in the neighborhood who had hospital access, because their electrolytes can be so disturbed that they need to be hospitalized suddenly. But I worked with bulimics and with compulsive overeaters, so I'm familiar and they don't see their bodies very accurately or appreciate that they work
It's interesting because the bulimia and the compulsive overeating, I think, kind of fit the addictive model.
Yes.
But anorexia is different. It seems like it's, I can't say that I understand all of it, but I tend towards anorexia, and I would definitely not call myself an anorexic, but I went through an anorexic stage of life, and I still deal with encouraging myself to eat when I'm, or to even just know that I'm hungry. Yeah.
Well, sometimes there's an unconscious fear with anorexia or something resembling it that, I'm in control. I can even live on air. I don't need food. Right.
That's so funny. I was at a party a few years ago and a woman accused me of being a breatharian.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Well, yeah. But
yeah.
I had eaten that day. She just hadn't seen me eat.
So another question, because the hour goes by quickly, especially you, Veronica. So the question is, do men also suffer from body shame? And if so, how? What is your experience with that?
Increasingly so. Now, I'm glad we're talking about eating disorders, because the statistics bear out that there are a lot more young men starting to develop eating disorders.
Yes.
And we're mostly focused on the ones that are still in high school. Mm-hmm. And it is, again, we can point back to the media representation. So the advertisers realize that women are 51% of every dollar spent. So they started catering to female tastes with the advertising, and we got to see a whole bunch of guys with ripped abs. And now we've got all kinds of young men out there starving themselves to try to get ripped abs.
Mm.
So it does absolutely happen. I think we're going to see more and more of it, unfortunately. And there's a way in which, we have got to move this culture to a place that's loving and life-affirming for all genders. That's just really where we've got to take things.
I so agree with you. To be loving and life-affirming, and then that means that we're better adjusted and we're usually happier. And we usually can be more generous with ourselves and with others, and love ourselves and others better.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that makes for such a good life, you know.
And a nice, happy planet.
And a happy planet, yes. We have a lot of disruptions right now, though. And we have to work a little harder. You know, I'm thinking President Trump. It's just, he's a huge disappointment.
You know, I am hearing a lot of rumors that Germany's Chancellor Merkel,
yes,
is actually on her way to becoming the leader of the free world. I don't know what that means for the world, but nations in general are not looking to Trump anymore. So,
well, and Germany has such a thriving economy that they seem to work very well there.
With a woman leading the way.
Well, yes. Merkel. Yay, Merkel. Veronica, we will definitely we'll do this again.
Okay.
I think you are an amazing woman. You've lived life. You're still living it. You're experiencing it. You're helping others.
Thank you, Diana.
Doing this program today, I think that many will be helped by this conversation we've been having. And
I think this was our best one yet, Diana.
Oh, good. See, good for you. Yes, you noticed. And we know each other a little bit better. And,
we do.
Yes. So, and then also, we'll want to talk next time, I'm making a note, about your formula. Say it again for our listeners.
The Exquisite Partnership Formula.
Right.
The five-step process for taking conflict and turning it into connection, to turning your no into a golden opportunity to connect hearts and feel more intimate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful thing. And so the next time you're on, we'll talk about that. But meantime, it'll be up on the Shame-Free...
Shamefreezone.com,
yes. I'll make sure that it's right when I do the summary of this.
Okay.
Shamefreezone.com. And we did talk on May 9th. Your workshops are tied in with this, claiming your erotic birthright as a woman.
Yes, yes. We're going to be meeting in Mexico next March.
Wow.
And already setting up the, taking reservations for that. We've got a cutoff the end of October to get $100 off on registration. So your listeners can also contact me about that. And I will shoot you over my landing page so that if they want to register for that, it'll be real easy for them.
Okay. That sounds like a really good idea. Where in Mexico will you be?
We're just 10 miles south of Puerto Vallarta.
Oh, nice. Well, there's the closing music. So thank you, Veronica, for a wonderful program.
Sending you lots of love and light, Diana.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye, everybody.